The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy, and how you can make the most of your own life, right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and I am, as always, delighted to have this spot Mondays at 5 p.m. on this marvelous Progressive Radio Network. There's so much wonderful stuff going on in the universe of psychiatric reform right now that I thought I'd just take a minute and catch you up on some of what we are doing. My wife created a professional Facebook for me not very long ago, and today we exceeded 1,000 people who I guess say they like it. That makes them like members. I still don't have all this down pat. And on this Facebook, we asked the question, basically, do psychiatric drugs ever do any good? And we have gotten pages. I've got like 15 pages of really interesting responses that have just come overnight to that one question. And it's clear that people are getting more sophisticated about this. If I had raised a question like this at the start of my work in the 70s, or when I first really took on the psychiatric drugs in the 80s and early 90s, I would have gotten a lot of dismay. How could you ask that question? Are you crazy? What are you talking about? You should be off the air. Indeed, all sorts of things were done to try to keep me from speaking out in those days. But now the answers, albeit to my page, so it's going to be a certain amount of special direction from those, they're more mixed now. Some people are saying they never work. My life was ruined by them. Can't tell you how many communications we get about lives being ruined by psychiatric medications. Other people are saying, well, I was hurt by them, so we need to do them more carefully. Maybe if they were done right. At least one listener gave the view that while they wouldn't want to use psychiatric drugs, it should be up to the individual to use them, providing that person was adequately informed. And all this raises lots of different issues. Is anyone ever adequately informed about a psychiatric drug? Can someone like me, who tries to stay on top of things, ever be adequately informed about the dangers and risks, or simply the truth about psychiatric drugs? And I'll be getting to that in a few minutes with my very interesting guest today, who's done some very important research around this question of the truth about psychiatric drugs, although he put it much more scientifically and objectively than that. To start with, I want to tell you a little story that will set you up perhaps for understanding some more of where I'm coming from and what the issues are and how large they are. In the early 1990s, hundreds of suits were brought against Eli Lilly, the manufacturer of Prozac, because in the first few years, there had been innumerable reports of violence, suicide, murder, mayhem, all kinds of severe mental aberrations among people taking this drug. Albeit millions were taking it, but nonetheless, it was new to have so many, many reports. And in fact, the FDA did a comparative study of the numbers of reports they got per prescription for Prozac on violence and suicide and other such things compared to another antidepressant, factoring in the number of prescriptions, and Prozac was way ahead on how many reports the FDA was getting about serious, serious mental and behavioral abnormalities. And these were in both the arena of violence and the arena of suicide. At around this time, early on, and by the way, the Prozac reports were coming in before there was a scandal, a national scandal, in part created by this Dr. Peter Breggin that you're listening to. These lopsided reports about Prozac were coming in before there was a scandal associated with it. Then in the early 1990s, as a result of my book, Toxic Psychiatry, which predicted that these were dangerous drugs, similar in some of their worst effects to amphetamine and cocaine, I was asked to be the expert for all the combined Prozac suits. There were more than 150 of them that were put together in Indianapolis, which is the home area of Eli Lilly in Indiana. And I was going to be and became the scientific expert to evaluate the science behind all of the lawsuits. So all the individual lawyers wouldn't have to get to all their own scientists. And so Eli Lilly wouldn't have to be producing discovery materials for all the different scientists. It was just going to be me for the initial suits looking at what was going on inside Eli Lilly. Now, the first lawyer that was chosen to head up this committee of lawyers, on which I would be the scientific expert, I didn't feel comfortable working with. I thought he was heading in directions that I couldn't go in as an expert. And I made one of the biggest decisions of my life to just follow my ethics and to drop out of what looked like the most interesting project I'd ever been involved in, and also remunerative. I get paid a great deal to do legal work, but I quit. It then turned out that this lawyer was fired or removed, and another really fine lawyer, well-known from Chicago, was brought in, and he died. And then a third lawyer was brought in who would finally be involved in the first suit. He was brought in toward the last minutes. Now, along the way, what did I find as I looked in at the internal workings of Eli Lilly and the way they conducted their tests and studies? One of the first things I noticed was they were making claims that they had studied 10,000 people. Sometimes it was 1,500 people. Never was it a few hundred people. So I looked at all the Eli Lilly studies and laboriously counted the actual number of people who finished the studies, that is, who took the drug for 4 to 6 weeks, because that's as long as the studies went, the actual number of people who took the drug to the completion of the studies. It was less than 300. Not 3,000, but less than 300. I then looked at how the studies were conducted and was surprised to find that most of them ruled out severely depressed patients. They didn't use hospital patients, I think, except maybe in one study, and that didn't show anything good for the drug. They ruled out disturbed patients. And then they did this odd thing, which turned out nobody had ever challenged, but which the FDA was letting everybody do, which is they'd give all the patients a placebo to begin with. And if you got better on the placebo, they dropped you out of the study. And then they randomly chose their study patients and their placebo patients from among those who hadn't originally responded to placebo. In other words, they loaded the deck for Prozac by starting out by removing all the people who responded initially to placebo. So now you got a study in which there aren't so many placebo responders. It's not a normal group anymore. It's not what the general public's going to look like. Well, this was allowed by the FDA. It's still allowed by the FDA. I searched the literature, and I became the first person to point out the irrationality of allowing the drug companies to do this. But it got worse from there. I found an internal memo from the head of the scientific part of Eli Lilly to all the bought doctors who were doing the studies, actually, you know, conducting the controlled clinical trials. And it said, we're having so much agitation caused by Prozac, in effect it said this, that we have to start giving patients tranquilizers to calm them down when necessary. Well, what's the matter with this? Well, first, it wasn't allowed by the FDA in the original plan, so it's not in the plan. It's essentially illegal. It's outside the plan. Secondly, it means you're not only testing Prozac, you're testing Prozac and tranquilizers. So benefit like sleeping better or less anxious is going to be coming from the tranquilizers. And we're talking about drugs like, you know, Klonopin, Xanax, Ativan, tranquilizing drugs. Another thing that was wrong with this is that these are addictive drugs. All right. So now it comes to be time for the FDA to approve Prozac. And all the company has to do out of its many studies is pick two. Well, the only way in their pick two gamble that they could make Prozac look good was if they included the patients on tranquilizers, which wholly confounded and made false the findings. The FDA was faced with saying to Eli Lilly, hey, you guys, you've spent millions on this, but forget it, we're not approving your drug. And they would have had to say that to George Bush, who had once been on the board of directors of Eli Lilly and was president at the time, although this is not a political issue, the Dems are just as bad. They would have had to say no to his vice president, who was himself from Indiana and very closely associated with Eli Lilly. So they had a problem. So what did they do? They said to Eli Lilly, we will accept your studies. And so Prozac was approved, not as Prozac, but Prozac also, when necessary, in combination with tranquilizing drugs. But that wasn't even the worst of that. For most of the studies, they didn't have enough patients finishing the studies in order to really make them valid, so they ignored that. But then it gets worse. They had problems being charged with causing suicide with their drugs and suicidal behavior. The Germans became very concerned about this, so they said, we want you to do a study comparing just looking at suicide attempts for all your controlled clinical trials. So Eli Lilly, for the Germans, did an evaluation, and this is what I found. This was secret. I found this as the one person empowered by the courts to examine the internal documents of Eli Lilly. I found this. So what do I find? I found that they had done a study. They examined the number of suicidal behaviors attempts, particular attempts, they were getting on Prozac compared to an older antidepressant and compared to placebo. And there was a vastly larger number, it was like 12 to 1, more suicide attempts on Prozac. It was so bad that they had to call in a specialist who then culled out some of the cases of suicidal behavior and suicide attempts, or rather, and said, we won't count those. Well, that's not legitimate. That's why you have a double blind, so that the people who are deciding that something's a suicide attempt don't know whether it was on Prozac or a sugar pill. But they forgot about that, and they just culled out the ones. They still couldn't get it down to the point where it didn't look bad for Prozac. And they actually gave an opinion, one of their experts, that it might be that Prozac was causing energy and anxiety in people and worsening their suicide attempts, increasing them. What did Eli Lilly do with this material? They hid it. They never gave it to the Germans. They never gave it to our FDA. But it doesn't stop there. As reports of suicide began to pour into Eli Lilly and suicide attempts, they started to reclassify them. So a doctor would send in a report, and the report would say, suicide attempt or suicidal behavior or suicidal ideation, and Lilly would reclassify it as no drug effect or some other innocent thing. It gets worse. I found memos from within Eli Lilly. They're Europeans writing, European staff members of Eli Lilly, writing to the central office in Indiana saying, in one case a memo saying, how can I explain this to a judge? How can I explain this to our critics? How can I explain this to our children, what we're doing? Literally a shame-filled memo. We never found the answer from Eli Lilly. Well, eventually, all this material was going to come out in the lawsuit. And the first lawsuit was the case of Joseph Westbecker. And before the suit was going to take place, the official name was Fentress. It was a mass murder, a man who had gone into his place of work on Prozac, just after stopping Prozac, and killed, I think it was eight people, and wounded a dozen more. There were 20 deaths and injuries, lots of money involved. But it was the worst possible suit to go first with. Why didn't this new lawyer call him Joe? Why did Joe pick the worst suit of all and agree with Eli Lilly to bring such a difficult suit? Mass murder, totally unsympathetic. Why did he do that? Why didn't Joe, the lawyer, ever work with me on my what I was going to present to the jury? Usually a lawyer would work for a week with you in a big case like this, but the lawyer never worked with me. Why would the lawyer hide information from me? Every bit of information I had, I got myself, yet I found out there were 20, 30 depositions done that I wasn't told about. Well, my wife said, the trial's fixed, honey. She said, this trial's fixed. I didn't believe her. I said, that can't be fixed. Came time for me to testify, and the lawyer still hadn't reviewed any questions with me. So I shoved 20 note cards in his hand. He said, you better ask me these questions. I don't know what you're doing, but you got to ask me these. He got very mad at me. We had an argument, terrible argument. When I got up to testify, he didn't protest the attacks on me from the other lawyer. He didn't ask me a lot of the important questions, so I began making up questions and answers for myself. I'd say, and also about the subject of their trials that the Germans asked for. And I would just go off and march off and testify on my own. It was a bizarre situation. Turned out that despite this lawyering that went on, the trial was almost a hung jury. It was a 9-3 vote. One more vote against Lilly, 8-5. And it would have been a hung jury. So they won a victory that was really quite compromised, but all the press reported was victory by Eli Lilly. I thought, my God, I don't know what happened. That was just a disaster. We don't want to do legal work anymore. No idea what's going on here. My wife said they fixed the trial. Then a few months later, out comes an article called Kentucky Fried Chicken in a journal in New Jersey. Turns out they fixed the trial. They consciously withheld data and information from the jury in return for which they got paid off by Eli Lilly. So the lawyer I was working with was in cahoots with Eli Lilly. And then he promptly went ahead and lost all the discovery, except I had it, which lawyers around the world didn't know, but he lost the discovery, supposedly. Turned out Eli Lilly stashed it in some other place. All very confusing. Finally, the judge caught on, and he ordered a hearing. And he concluded that Eli Lilly had not won this trial. He reversed it and said it had been settled with prejudice against Eli Lilly. And the state Supreme Court of Kentucky said that Lilly had manipulated the system and maybe even committed fraud, but they never followed up on that. Now, what did the press do with this amazing finding? All the press that had reported Eli Lilly had won, none of them reported Eli Lilly had actually fixed the trial when that came out. And so Lilly won this massive PR victory. Lots of lawyers never even heard to this day that the trial was fixed, and they dropped out or they gave in easily. Okay, this is the size of the catastrophe we're talking about in terms of manipulation by the drug companies. If you want to read in detail with tons of references my most detailed description of the Westbecker case, you'll find it in my new book, Medication Madness, paperback, easy to get. Actually, if you join our association, go to my website. or go to BregenBregan.com or go to EmpathicTherapy.com, and you will find a link where you can get the book, where you can get some of the articles that I've written about all of this, or go and join the organization, EmpathicTherapy.org, and you'll get a free copy of Medication Madness with a whole chapter on the Westbecker case. And if you want to get all the detail on what I was just telling you about the drug company, Eli Lilly, and how it manipulated its data, get my new updated Talking Back to Prozac, the original book about all this by myself and my wife, Ginger, Talking Back to Prozac. And it just came out now. It's both an e-book and a hardback book and a new edition with a 30-page introduction that will catch you up on everything. So that's just my introduction to, hey, guys, hey, people out there, we really need to be aware of just how much manipulation goes into so-called scientific studies. Now, my guest today is a specialist in an area of this. And before I get into more introduction, are you there, Ed? You with us?
Hi there, Peter.
Been able to hear my intro?
Oh, fascinating. I was very captivated by it.
Good. Don't want to do anything but that. It's incredible information. Now, my guest is Ed Pigott. His name is spelled P-I-G-O-T-T. Ed is a very interesting and unusual man. We met in a way that sounds like something more than chance. My dear friend Brian Keene, who is the editor of the journal that I founded years ago, Ethical Human Psychology and Psychiatry, was visiting with me for a couple of weeks, and he's telling me about this interesting paper he's gotten examining the study called the STAR-D that was supposed to have shown that, once again, that antidepressants work. They're always trying to show it because they haven't shown it yet, that antidepressants work. He's telling me about this interesting study. And then my wife is telling Brian and me about this interesting man who's just gotten in touch with us and is communicating on our lines, on our center lines, which you can get onto by going to empathictherapy.org and finding all the various ways that you can communicate with like-minded people. And it turns out to be the same guy who neither of us had ever met, though he's from Maryland. Ed is here. When I got in touch with him, he was doing something even more interesting in evaluating STAR-D. He was making wine. So we talked on the phone for about an hour for the first time, some about making wine in Maryland. Ed works in a different way than most folks who are in this area. He's actually an entrepreneur. And he works as a consultant to various kinds of organizations. I hope he'll tell you some of his interesting experiences consulting with drug companies. He's also consulted with groups that do alternative work, which is interesting. Ed Pigott, welcome to the show, and maybe introduce yourself a little more and tell us a little bit in terms that even I can understand and everybody else can about the STAR-D and your research into that federally funded project.
Okay. Thank you, Peter. I'm a licensed psychologist, I oftentimes describe myself as basically, originally I was very much a researcher, but then became sort of at times an entrepreneur as well, basically working to try to implement the findings of good solid research. And so, my first company that I did was called PATH, Positive Alternatives to Hospitalization, that I set up in Connecticut, where it was based on research from the 1960s and 1970s, where they randomly assigned people who are presenting in psychiatric crisis for hospitalization, and they assign them either to a intensive alternative service or the inpatient service. And consistently in all those studies, the patients who were treated with the intensive crisis intervention service outside the hospital setting typically had four times lower hospital psychiatric relapse rates. So in other words, those who typically when they were hospitalized, it would frequently, that would set them on a pattern of continued rehospitalizations compared to those given this alternative service. And so I, as a psychologist, set that up in Connecticut. I first did it in the nonprofit sector, and then I set it up working with health plans in Connecticut, where basically we had a network of we had two psychiatrists, we had a group of psychologists and clinical social workers, and what we would do is basically within an hour of a referral, we would have somebody on site in the client's home or in their workplace or going into the emergency room. And we published a study on this, and our results were very similar with 2-year follow-up rates, where basically we were able to both avert the need for psychiatric hospitalization about 85% of the time, and then for those people that we worked with intensively in their home environment, we were able to, when the 2-year follow-up rate, they had dramatically lower relapse rates, basically.
Give us an idea about what happens in that hour. You get there, let's say you're in a home.
Right.
You get there, who are you? Who gets there and what do you do and who's in the home? And give us let us know just what it feels like to be there.
Well, you're coming in. You're coming into a crisis situation. What I would always do, and you know, you have to have, we would pick our therapists. We made sure we're highly skilled and also highly empathic, easy to relate to people, not trying to impose themselves on others. And by showing up that quickly, you know, that kind of communicated to the both to the client and to the family that our responsiveness to them. We would then also we taught our therapists very strongly on this: never try to make a determination inside the first hour or so about what you think the disposition is going to be need to be for this case, because you know, basically most crises run there's a course that they run. And if you don't want to make an evaluation that's going to affect this person's life when you're coming into it and everybody's in this highly agitated state, and by engaging with both the client and the family, you're typically over the course of several hours able to reduce that agitation. They're calmer, and then you're able to make a much better assessment. But what oftentimes happens, you know, psychiatrists or others working in an emergency room, when somebody comes in, they're making decisions right away.
Right.
While they're still all
and one of the first things that I teach people about therapy is when the patient's having an emergency, you don't have an emergency. You stay calm, you stay empathic, you stay caring, and you act as if it can all work out, and the odds are it will more quickly than you think. Is that your experience?
Oh, exactly. What I would say to myself in the back of my mind while I'm in a, you know, engaging and you know, people might be yelling at you, they might be whatever, and I would just repeat in the back of my mind, this too will pass.
There you go.
And, you know, and as long as you're not getting agitated and in response to them, that calms them down.
Can you imagine how much good would be done in the universe if America's 40,000 psychiatrists listened to this, and the next time a new patient walked into their office, they thought to themselves, this too will pass. I'll be patient. I won't do anything radical.
Exactly. And it's really operating from that adage, first do no harm.
Exactly. And we're going to take a break in a minute. This is the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. You are listening to Dr. Bregan, Peter, and to Ed Pigott, psychologist and very interesting entrepreneur.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
You are listening to Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Eric Davis, host of Expanding Mind. Join me and co-host Maja Daou each week as we explore the culture of consciousness, spirituality, neuroscience, media tech, and all manner of wonders and esoterica. Expanding Mind streams every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your mind open.
The Progressive Radio Network is looking to expand its programming, and we are looking for your ideas. If there's a subject that you are passionate about and we don't cover it, let us know. Give us a call at 646-307-4482 or email our program director, Carolee@GaryKnoll.com. That's K-A-R-A-L-E-E at GaryKnoll.com. The Progressive Radio Network, the number one forum for progressive minds.
Freedom News Hour will bring you up to date on the latest news on the financial meltdown.
Begin restoring local communities. It can happen.
We'll be exploring the issues from a freedom-oriented, small government perspective.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster.
I am Jake Towne.
Join us live Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one forum that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
You are listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, bringing you back to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. And to my guest, Dr. Ed Pigott, P-I-G-O-T-T. Ed, I had a couple of brief questions, but first let me catch people up to what we've been talking about. I began talking about the enormous disillusionment that I've had going through the initial Prozac trials, where I was the medical expert for all the combined Prozac trials, the scientific and medical expert. I talked some about the more greater sophistication now that we have, the people who are writing to my Facebook page, my professional page, and how complexly they're, in a sophisticated way, they're looking at the issues nowadays. And I introduced Ed Pigott talking about how he was going to evaluate the STAR-D studies, one more false attempt to prove the antidepressants useful. But before we got there, we got to a more important place. And Ed talked about a program that he'd been involved in, evaluating and participating in, mobile intensive crisis intervention, instead of hospitalization, where you go right into the home, and 80% or more of the time people didn't end up needing hospitalization, which means it's less expensive, less traumatic to the individual, less humiliating, and if we were doing it nowadays, it could be with less medication, although that, from what I understand, wasn't one of the aims at the time. Ed, first, how can people get in touch with you?
Several ways. One is I have a website, www.dr, for doctor, Ed Pigott. So it's dredpigott.com. And so that has, that's my clinical practice website. And then there's also from that, my email address is Pathware, PATHWARE, at Errols, EROLS.com. The Pathware is my second company was a software company that was an internet-based software company where we had an interesting app that would help people go in and basically it was a treatment planning application, but from the perspective of the client, of the individual. So they would take assessments, have those fed back to them. They would then be able to identify what's important for them from a treatment perspective. And then they could look at a range of treatment options that the research had found effective. And so it was a totally individual client-driven assessment and treatment planning process versus how it's typically done. And again, the idea there, as we talked yesterday, Peter, was because Albert Bandura is one of my real big heroes, this psychologist from Stanford, and he's done a lot of research on looking at the role of increasing a person's sense of personal efficacy or personal power and just how powerful that is in changing their lives. And so I think from a treatment standpoint, the things that you can do to empower the individual to make those decisions for themselves, you're just going to much more likely have positive outcomes from that.
It's astonishing to me to talk to some of my patients who have been in therapy before for 7, 8 years, or shorter periods of time, and at no point did the therapist or the psychiatrist come to grips with the single most important factor in success in life, which is taking responsibility, taking charge, becoming empowered, whatever language you want to use for this process of self-determination, which is the single key to getting anything done, whether you're going to build a wall in your garden or learn to train your dog or become a better husband or wife, or overcome anxiety, guilt, shame, learn to relate to people better, whatever it is you're going to do, it has to start with you being determined to make it happen one way or another, never throwing yourself on the mercy of others, but empowering yourself to find the help you need, whether it's from people or books or contemplation or God or AA, to find what you need, and maybe multiple things, in order to empower yourself and grow. And this is just not one of the themes at all of psychiatry, and maybe a little more in psychology, and certainly more in counseling, but it's just not nearly enough, yet it's the central principle. Would you agree with that?
Oh, strongly, very strongly.
Now, you did some other stuff that, before we get to the critique of STAR-D, and if we don't, people just have to wait to read it in the journal,
okay.
Ethical Human Psychology and Psychiatry. But before we get there, you had worked with an organization, and we don't have to get into the details of it, but you had worked with an organization that advertised on TV that was developing methods of self-help, where people who were had learned self-empowerment were helping other people with empowerment. Can you say a little bit about that, or just about this general concept
of
people helping each other?
For 3 years, I was consulting for Midwest Center for Stress and Anxiety, and they advertised. Lucinda Bassett was the founder spokesperson, who she herself was a sufferer of both panic disorder as well as depression. And they had developed a series of audio tapes as well as a workbook for people that basically could use on their own to address their issues of anxiety and depression. It's called Attacking Anxiety and Depression. What was so interesting to me about it was it was very good content in terms of the cognitive behavior therapy kind of strategies as well as others, but it was all written in the voice of the sufferer. And so whereas most times when you see those kinds of self-help books, they're written by a professional, and they don't necessarily relate as well, whereas this one was very much written in the voice of the sufferer, their materials, and so I was very impressed by that. But then what I got involved in with them is they had a peer coaching service whereby people could sign up for it, and once a week you would have a half an hour, 40-minute call with a peer coach who would help them work through each week's lesson. And basically it was a way of, besides giving the person support in working through the material, it was also a way of, holding that person accountable. You know, because they knew they had somebody that they were going to have a call with, to make sure that they did their homework. And but the what was interesting about that that study that I was doing for them, basically the people who were signing up for it had on average failed 4 or 5 times in prior treatment, oftentimes using different kinds of psychiatric medications. So this was a fairly severe group of people suffering with anxiety and depression. But with the measures that we were using, we were finding inside of the first 4 weeks that people were making tremendous gains on average. And by the end of the 15 weeks of the program, the measure that we were using was the same called the SF-12, and it basically assessed the extent to which somebody's mental health problems were affecting their daily lives, things that they did each day. And by the end, people were, they had improved by what this term called 2.5 standard deviation. Basically, they'd become normal in terms of how, on average. And then we also did a...
By the way, that never happens in studies of psychiatric drugs. They don't even have normal as one of the points you can get to in their evaluations. They
exactly.
just like to see a little symptom improvement.
Right.
So we're talking about a massive difference. Ed, is there any program like this around now that people could get in touch with or learn about?
I believe it is still. The original founders of that ended up selling the company, but Midwest Center for Stress and Anxiety is still functioning today. I stopped doing consulting work for them.
So people can find them on the website?
Right. So you can find if they just typed in, Googled Attacking Anxiety and Depression.
This will come up?
Yes, it will come up, and they have...
Midwest Center?
www.stresscenter.com.
All right. Now, we're not endorsing this.
Right.
I'm not. I know nothing about it, but I am so happy to hear about alternatives. Now, Ed, this... The mobile intensive crisis intervention, did that continue? Do we have any of those going on around the country that you talked about in the first part of the hour?
They tend to be more. I sold that in 1993. I continued to work for another year there, and then I got into the software side of thing. And then ultimately, what happened, sadly, is that. you know, your a lot of your managed care companies, they learned that they could just say no.
Yeah, exactly.
And so then the, you know, where we were, I mean, you know, we were staffed 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and we would be on site to about two-thirds of Connecticut within an hour. We had five locations, and so we were, but then at that time, you know, so we were paid well, you know, to go out and provide that service, and it took us a lot. But
yeah. Listen, what I want people to know is that establishment psychiatry, which includes the AMA, the APA, the drug companies, in this case the health insurers, they are never going to support the methods that work. Because the methods that work involve empathic therapy by caring individuals meeting real needs. And that's outside this biological medical establishment. So one of the things that my wife Ginger and I are hoping to do is let people know that alternatives work and that we're going to have to set up these alternatives on our own.
Mm-hmm.
That caring professionals, caring, what you're calling sufferers, individuals who have been through the psychiatric mill, the survivors, that we are going to have to develop these methods on our own. One of the things I'm going to do for the first time is I'm going to start soon developing some training tapes of what I do.
Mm-hmm.
All of us are going to have to start working to show that other methods work, that humane, direct, caring methods work. Come to empathictherapy.org, get involved with us, come to our, get our newsletter. My wife is writing this free, magnificent free newsletter. Come to our conference in April. You find out all about it on empathictherapy.org. You're listening to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour. I'm Breggin. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N. And you can find me at breggin.com or empathictherapy.com or many variations on that. And you're listening to my guest, Dr. Ed Pigott, who has done a lot of innovative and interesting things. The problem is sustaining these things, and we need an organization to support it, and that's what we're trying to provide, to give moral support to individuals who want to be developing their own empathic caring alternatives. Now, at the beginning, when I was talking about my hugely disillusioning but enlightening experiences with how drug companies, in this case Eli Lilly, manipulate their data and will even manipulate the U.S. justice system to promote their drugs, I'd like Ed now to talk about something he's been studying recently, the STAR-D research, and I'd like you to briefly, again, keeping in mind that this is a show for anybody who's interested in the arena, not necessarily for people who are familiar with the lingo, really intelligent people who can grasp what you're saying in plain English. Tell them about STAR-D, what it was, what it claimed, and what you found out.
Okay. STAR-D is the largest, most expensive study on the effectiveness of antidepressant drugs that's ever been conducted. It was funded with yours and my taxpayer dollars through the NIMH, the National Institute of Mental Health, excuse me, and they enrolled 4,041 people presenting in psychiatrist office and primary care doctor's offices presenting with depression, and it was set up with four different treatment levels. So the very first group was prescribed one of the SSRI medications, similar to Prozac, though it was not Prozac. And then if somebody had a remission while taking the medication, they were then moved into 12 months of free ongoing follow-up care. If they did not have a remission, they could go down to the next level of treatment where they might be prescribed, add in a second drug to the first drug, or they might be switched to a different antidepressant, depending on what the person wanted to
now,
do.
The purpose of this is to mimic private practice, right?
Yes.
Instead of having
correct.
A 6-week controlled clinical trial, you know, get your hands dirty, get out there and try to mimic what happens in the real world. So it's a naturalistic kind of a study.
Naturalistic, but with they did everything under the sun to maximize the likelihood that the people would benefit from the drug. So as you were saying, it was mimicking what happens in the real world from the standpoint that no one's ever given a sugar pill. So everybody knew that they were getting the active medication. Both the doctors and the patients knew what those drugs were.
So right away, there's no real control group.
There's no control group at all through in this
now,
study.
Now, oddly, the drug companies, whenever I testify in court, they say, well, if you haven't proven it in a control group clinical study, we don't want to hear about it. But here they're spending millions from the government, NIMH, in a non-control group study where you're going to just have to make some judgments on what's going on. Now, what did they claim to find, and what did you find?
Well, they claimed to find that cumulatively over the course of up to 4 treatments that approximately 70% of patients would have a remission, and that then those that went into ongoing follow-up care, that the relapse rate was somewhere around about 40% is what they claim to find. What we discovered, and it took, because out of the STAR*D study, what you need to understand is that there were over 70 articles that have been published on it. So
all
out
positive,
of that,
I'm sure.
I'm sorry?
All positive, I'm sure.
Oh, yes. Surprise,
isn't that amazing?
Surprise. And so it took a lot of effort to deconstruct what actually occurred in the study, kind of similar to you describing your experience at Eli Lilly and unraveling the Prozac thing. It was one of these things like peeling an onion. Each time, you know, you would take off that next peel, you thought you understood it all, and there was always another, you know, thing to peel. And basically what we discovered was that they ended up that STAR*D, one, they changed their research criteria, and so whereas they were supposed to be only allowing in people that were 14 or greater on this measure of depression, that they ended up allowing into the study about 25% of the people they allowed in the study who did not meet that criteria. They were much even less depressed. And on this measure, 14 is considered mild depression. So they were having some people in that were actually in the normal range, which is
isn't
just
that
kind of
amazing?
Bizarre.
All right. Well, that's pretty bizarre. What else did they do?
The other thing that we discovered is that they, in changing, they came up with a one of the there was this thing called the quick inventory for depressive symptoms that was not a research measure. It was used, the doctors would use it to at each of their visits to determine if they needed to increase the dose of medication for the person to adjust their dosing.
Right.
And it was explicit. So this was a measurement. This was a tool they were using to guide care in every clinic visit. But it was explicitly not a research measure. They had all of these. They had some blindly administered measures that were
so
the true research.
It wasn't a validated tool to use for determining success.
Correct. And what they then did is in reporting their remission rates. They ended up using this tool that was being administered in the clinic, not the research tool, not the research measures, and they that significantly inflated their remission rate. So, for instance, they reported a remission rate in step one of almost 39% remission rate. And what we discovered was that the actual, when you use the actual research measure that was pre-specified, that the actual rate was only about 25%. In other words, they basically inflated their step one yes. remission rate by almost 50%.
Did they have any measures where the patient got to say whether they were better?
They had these symptom scales. They also had some satisfaction measures, but those they've not reported the data on that.
I noticed that a lot. That what happens in a lot of these studies, folks, is all the psychiatrists who are getting paid a ton of money find a way to judge that you're a little better, just a little, I mean, because that's all they can manage to fake. But if you then look at the patient's self-ratings, they almost never come out better. So they're either non-reported or ignored. What's your summary of what this study is worth that is supposed to improve
the headline
drugs.
News, okay, is basically out of the 4,041, you know, people who were initially started on an antidepressant in the first step, and then after up to, if they didn't get better on that one, they could go to another one, and if they didn't get better on that one, they could go to, you know, up to four of these antidepressant trials. And then once they had gotten better, went into the 12 months of continuing care. Basically, out of the 4,041, there were only 108 survivors.
108 made it to the holy grail of getting better on all this.
Got better and then made it through 12 months of
what percent
of
is
the
that?
And that's 2.7%. Now, here's the funny thing, though, Peter.
I make the point in the article that's
already been published is out of those 108, we don't know how many of those might have been one of the 670 who never were sufficiently depressed to be included in the study originally, and so would have had to have gotten worse than when they started to be accounted as relapsed.
Now, listen, this is wonderful. Folks, you are on the front lines, unpublished data. You now know more than all the psychiatrists in America about what really happened in the STAR-D, and you're only going to get it here. Did you have
Peter, that data has – we published that data in July in the journal Psychotherapy and Psychosomatics. If people go there and then they click on the top five articles for that journal, my paper has been their number one download every month.
Say the name of it again, and we're going to be finishing in a minute.
Okay.
Say that name again where they can get that earlier paper.
Right. That is it's called Psychotherapy and Psychosomatics. It's a European-based psychiatry journal, Psychotherapy and Psychosomatics. The name of that paper is
well, they'll get it from your name.
From PIGA. If they just click on top five articles, it's been the number one download for the last.
Fabulous. Now, in a sentence, tell the world what happened when you submitted this STAR-D analysis that you just gave, that is it unpublished. When you gave this, when you sent this into the American Journal of Psychiatry, the official journal of American Psychiatry, what'd they write back to you?
Well, I just got a form letter rejection, that they did not send it out to peer review. The troubling thing there was in the letter that accompanied the article, I disclosed how I had email exchanges with the chief biostatistician from STAR-D confirming our analysis.
Yeah, they don't want the facts.
Exactly.
You've been listening to an astonishing, interesting psychologist, Ed Pigott, P-I-G-O-T-T. You can find him on the web. you just happen to be listening in now, you can get this show archived, usually within 24 hours, either through my website, Bregin.com, B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com, or through the Progressive Radio Network.com. I'm urging all of you to get involved with us, see what you can do, what you can learn, and how you can contribute to a better world through empathictherapy.org, the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, Education, and Living. Thank you for listening to the Dr. Peter Bregin Hour.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bregin Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where it is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bregin and his lifelong reform work on www.bregin.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.